thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Gary Scanlon, a principal in the same group. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Kristen. Excited about this episode.
Me too. So on January 5th, 2026, the OECD released comprehensive guidance on Pillar 2, entitled the Side-by-Side Package, because it includes the much-anticipated side-by-side safe harbor for U.S. multinationals. But it also includes safe harbors and guidance that could benefit their foreign peers. Indeed, while the United States has been a leader in the development of the side-by-side safe harbor, they are not the only country who brought ideas and demands to the table, and this package is a reflection of global motivations and negotiations. In today's episode, we'll explore the contents of the side-by-side package, their impact on both U.S. and foreign multinationals, as well as the long-term implications of this guidance. For our discussion today, we're excited to be joined by a distinguished panel of Pillar 2 experts from across KPMG's global network. Returning to the podcast is our friend and boss, Michael Plougin, co-principal in charge of KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, Kristen. Great to be back.
So we are also joined by two new guests to the podcast, Conrad Turley, the head of tax policy for the Global Tax Policy Group, and Alistair Pepper, a managing director in KPMG's WNT EVS practice. Welcome to the podcast, Conrad and Alistair.
Delighted to be here. Many thanks.
Thanks for having me.
So today's topic is something we've been following closely for some time here, the side-by-side agreement at the OECD. Indeed, we had hoped to do an episode on this guidance at the end of last year, before the holidays, but unfortunately the world, or at least some members of the world, refused to cooperate. Before we dive into the agreement, let's do a quick refresh for our listeners on how we got here. So the Trump administration's hostility towards the OECD's Pillar 2 initiative has been well documented, as evidenced by a presidential memorandum early in Trump's second term, formally rejecting the OECD global tax deal, renouncing any prior U.S. commitments to the agreement, and stating that it would carry no force or effect in the U.S. unless approved by Congress. Despite this, last spring, Treasury sent four representatives to the Inclusive Framework Plenary in South Africa to negotiate a path forward for the U.S. and the OECD to coexist in a Pillar 2 world. This is where the term side-by-side was first coined. The goal of the U.S. was fairly simple, to shield U.S. multinationals from Pillar 2, because they're already subject to a robust, comprehensive, and complicated U.S. tax regime that serves the same goals as the Pillar 2 regime. Subjecting U.S. multinationals to GLO would not only risk an additional substantive tax liability as a result of divergences between Pillar 2 and the U.S. tax system, but maybe even more importantly, it would compel U.S. multinationals to incur significant costs to comply with Pillar 2, in addition to the already substantial costs incurred to comply with the U.S. tax system. It's like putting a hat on a hat. The ire of the administration and the Republican-controlled Congress toward the potential application of Pillar 2 to U.S. multinationals, particularly the application of the UTPR to their domestic profits, culminated in the proposal of Section 899, aka the revenge tax in the OB3. However, before the OB3 was finalized in June, the G7 agreed to a side-by-side system, and Congress dutifully removed the revenge tax from the OB3. The G7 agreement, while not binding, was based upon accepted principles, importantly that a side-by-side system would be developed that would fully exclude U.S. parented groups from the UTPR and the IAR in respect to both their domestic and foreign profits. The side-by-side package represents the culmination of negotiations that have occurred at the OECD since June. So, Michael, let's start with what I think our U.S. listeners will be most excited to hear about, the side-by-side safe harbor. The G7 agreement more or less promised U.S. multinationals protection from the IAR and UTPR. Does the side-by-side safe harbor fulfill that promise? And what exactly does the safe harbor provide?
Yeah, I'd say it really does deliver on that promise. The core elements are there. The safe harbor provides an exclusion for U.S. parented groups from both the IIR and UTPR on U.S. and foreign profits. So if a UPE is located in the U.S., the IIR and UTPR are turned off for all constituent entities in the group. And the way I phrase that is actually important. A UPE can be located in the U.S., even if it's a flow through like a partnership. And that's been a big open question for taxpayers with an S corp or a partnership UPE. And it looked like that was favorably answered by the guidance, even though the agreement doesn't explicitly say anything about partnerships or flow throughs more broadly in that regard. It's important to note, however, that even though the IIR and the UTPR are turned off, QDMTTs continue to apply. So U.S. multinationals still have to care about Pillar 2 and about the other parts of the agreement that we'll talk about here. In addition, the safe harbor only kicks in for 2026. So that means that the IIR can apply to U.S. multinationals for 2024. For example, if you've got an intermediate parent entity that has an IIR and a low-taxed subsidiary underneath that, and the UTPR can apply for 2025 with respect to the foreign profits, right? The UTPR safe harbor for 2025 means that the UTPR doesn't apply to U.S. profits in 2025, just non-U.S. profits.
So you make a really important point, Michael, that U.S. multinationals could still be subject to Pillar 2 on a go-forward basis with respect to their foreign profits through the QDMTT. Does that mean U.S. multinationals are still required to file the Globe Information Return, or GIR, in the future?
Yeah, and that was, I think, one of the key things that taxpayers were looking for in this agreement. And U.S. multinationals will have to file GIRs, but the requirements will change over time. So for 2024 and 2025, U.S. multinationals will have to file a full GIR. But because of the country-by-country safe harbor, hopefully the compliance burden will be reduced for that. For 2026 and beyond, U.S. multinationals will have to file a simplified GIR to comply with QDMTT requirements, but there won't be any IIR or UTPR information on that. And that was a little bit surprising to me to see that initially, but as you think about it, it might actually be burden reducing to have a simplified GIR, because you may be able to get more standardization on the filing requirements for QDMTT jurisdictions that way.
Thanks, Michael. So when we last spoke about the G7 agreement on an earlier episode of the podcast, we discussed that one of the negotiating points for the U.S. was with respect to the QDMTT ordering rule. Specifically, the U.S. wanted to change that ordering rule to allow U.S. multinationals to push down their GILTI and Subpart F taxes for purposes of the QDMTT. Does the side-by-side safe harbor address this?
It does, but it actually goes the other way. QDMTTs come first. And in fact, a requirement for the side-by-side system is that the U.S. give a foreign tax credit for QDMTTs. So as you say, early in the negotiations, Treasury talked about pushing down GILTI taxes as one of their priorities for, I think, pretty obvious reasons. If the U.S. taxing right comes first, that's obviously beneficial from a U.S. revenue perspective. I think it's equally obvious, though, why that was a difficult position to maintain. That would be the U.S. asserting a primary taxing right on profits of an entity that's resident in another jurisdiction, where those profits arise in that jurisdiction. If you don't like the UTPR, it's pretty hard to be okay with that position. And moreover, GILTI just isn't set up to be a primary taxing right. We give credit for taxes imposed by the other country. Now, incidentally, you might think, and there's been some chatter about this, that a country would want to allow GILTI pushdown to attract investment from U.S. multinationals. And if a domestic minimum top-up tax does do that, allows for GILTI pushdown, it's pretty clearly not going to be a QDMTT, not a qualifying domestic minimum top-up tax. though it might still be a cover tax. But if you do that, you run into the question, and I think we've talked about this in other episodes, of whether any residual tax imposed under that DMTT would be creditable for U.S. purposes.
So there also been some concern that if U.S. multinationals were granted an exemption from Pillar 2, specifically with respect to the application of the UTPR and IR to their foreign profits, that investment hubs like Singapore or Bermuda could incentivize U.S. investment by adopting a QDMTT that is turned off solely for U.S. multinationals. That is, it would still apply to foreign multinationals because that tax is going to be collected somewhere and might as well be in the investment hub. But does this package address this concern?
It does, actually. They explicitly talk about that. And I think in part because there had been a lot of speculation about this topic. The guidance says that in that case where, you know, a country would apply a QDMTT discriminatorily or on a conditional basis, that is not going to be a QDMTT. And on top of that, it's not even going to be a covered tax. So you get no credit for it in the calculation of top-up tax under the IIR or UTPR for non-US groups. So that would make the jurisdiction much less attractive for non-US multinationals.
I do think that's an interesting point, though, because there's a risk that that approach, if you think about the UK as an example, if the UK stops giving credit in an IIR for QDMTT-like taxes in a low-tax jurisdiction, it ends up potentially penalizing its own multinationals for the sins of the foreign country, which seems like a slightly counterintuitive way to incentivize the behavior that you want to achieve.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, so this next question I'm going to direct to Conrad and or Alistair. So the side-by-side safe harbor isn't explicitly limited to the U.S. The package sets out objective criteria for qualification, but the U.S. is the only country listed on the so-called central record, which, by the way, sounds awfully ominous, as currently qualifying for the safe harbor. So can other countries qualify, and how?
You're right, Gary. So they've essentially generalized the conditions, and effectively the two main conditions that need to be satisfied are that for the side-by-side safe harbor, you need to have an eligible domestic regime and an eligible worldwide regime. And I'll get into the details of that in a moment. But the other alternative that's open to countries is that they don't qualify as an eligible side-by-side regime, but they qualify as an eligible UPE regime, which is might also be attractive to some countries. And in order to enjoy that treatment, you only have to satisfy the first condition that you have an eligible domestic regime. So an eligible domestic regime is one in which the UPE jurisdiction taxes residents on a comprehensive measure of income at a rate of 20% or more, and is either a financial statement income-based corporate alternative minimum tax at a rate of 15% or more, or a QDMTT. And then an eligible worldwide regime is one in which the UPE jurisdiction imposes taxes on the UPE jurisdiction resident companies in relation to the profits of overseas subsidiaries and branches. And so one of the key factors there is that that home country regime needs to pick up both the active and passive income of foreign subsidiaries. So the United States obviously satisfies that because at home there's CAMTI and for overseas operations, GILTI and Subpart F. Other jurisdictions, they may have domestic minimum taxes applying to domestic profits, but generally speaking, most jurisdictions around the world will not have CFC rules that are as comprehensive as GILTI. Potentially one exception there, and bear in mind, as you rightly say, no other countries are listed at the moment, so potentially Brazil could be one that might satisfy both the domestic criteria, because they have a QDMTT from 2026 and they've got quite comprehensive CFC rules. Let's see whether they go down that road and put up their hand and make that application. As to which countries satisfy the UPE safe harbor, we've yet to see. I mean, for example, in the Chinese case, China is obviously another major country that hasn't adopted the Pillar 2 rules. At present, they don't have a domestic minimum tax. And Chinese CFC rules would not be as comprehensive as, say, guilty picking of active and passive foreign income. That being said, for the side-by-side safe harbor, essentially, there's two points in time at which an assessment would be made. They'll look at countries that have these rules in place as at the start of 2026, in effect, and they will look again, there's essentially a second window in 2027, 2028. So conceivably, a country like China, if they wanted to go down the road of adopting a domestic minimum tax and then also guilty style CFC rules by 27, 28, they could conceivably apply at that time. Whether they want to or not is another question. But it remains to be seen over the next couple of months which countries put their hands up to qualify for these particular treatments. But Alistair, you may have further thoughts on this.
I guess it's important to note for listeners that the UPE safe harbor is like a one hit. So you need to have the rules in place by 1 January 2026. So you can't make changes to your legislation in future periods to be eligible for the UPE safe harbor. The SBS safe harbor is different. There you could make changes and become eligible. I think it will be very interesting to see if anyone decides they want to pick up the complexity of the US taxes as an alternative to the complexity of Pillar 2. I don't know, Gary, if you think that's a good idea, but I haven't heard many people advocating for that.
I think it's a great idea for purposes of my child's college fund, but not for my foreign clients. So that's really helpful. I think there's a related question for Michael. Is there anything the U.S. can do to fall off the list? Importantly, one of the requirements, as Conrad pointed out, for the qualification for the side-by-side safe harbor is having a book-based 15% corporate alternative minimum tax. Perhaps coincidentally, we have a book-based 15% corporate alternative minimum tax called CAMTI. But what happens if we repeal CAMTI, for instance? I mean, many Republican members of Congress are chomping at the bit to do so. Does that endanger the side-by-side qualification for the U.S., or is there more at play here?
It's certainly possible that the U.S. could get kicked off the list. I don't want to say that something is impossible, but I'd say it's probably unlikely. That's not how these processes tend to work. I think the bigger question from my perspective is what happens to Pillar 2, and is the list even meaningful in 5 years? I think the package that we've seen really gives Pillar 2 the best shot that was possible given the current circumstances at stabilizing and actually being meaningful over the short to medium term.
And I think we'll get more into the long-term and medium-term implications of this a little bit later on. But another concern for the U.S., at least, you know, the last few years, was the treatment of certain tax incentives, particularly the R&D credit. Under the model rules, non-refundable credits like R&D, in contrast to refundable credits, reduced covered taxes, and this could potentially subject companies that benefited from these credits to a top-up tax. This perhaps is less important now for U.S. multinationals, or completely unimportant, at least with respect to R&D credit, but could still be important for foreign multinationals who potentially could benefit from local country tax incentives. Does this package address the treatment of these types of tax incentives?
Yeah, as you say, that was a big issue, or has been a big issue for the U.S. for the past couple of years, especially with respect to the treatment of the U.S. R&E credit, which is, as you say, was treated less favorably than other countries' refundable R&E credits. And that became an issue for other countries as well. You know, a lot of countries have non-refundable tax incentives. And what the package does, what was agreed, was to add back certain qualifying tax incentives, QTIs, that are expenditure-based or production-based. And so you can add back those incentives, the value of those incentives, up to a cap of 5.5% of the greater of payroll or depreciation on tangible assets, or there's an alternative cap of 1% of the carrying value of tangible assets. And it's interesting because that treatment, just adding back the taxes, is even better than the treatment for qualified refundable tax credits, where you add back the benefits to cover taxes, but you also add that to income in the denominator. So it's less of a beneficial effect on your ETR for QRTCs than for these new QTIs. And so the agreement actually allows a taxpayer to elect to treat some QRTCs as QTIs if they otherwise qualify as expenditure-based or production-based. And it's not really clear why they came up with this new mechanism rather than just treating them as QRTCs.
Just to throw in a supplementary point, and Michael's already alluded to it, for many jurisdictions in Asia-Pacific, other parts of the world as well, but particularly in Asia-Pacific, super deductions for R&D or for investment expenditure are really a key part of their incentive mix. And so obtaining a measure of protection for these incentives, it's understood to be one of the high priorities for China and other Asia-Pacific countries in the negotiations. And so what the new rules do for super deductions is that they calculate the QTI, the qualified tax incentive amount, as the quantum of the super deduction and multiply it by the local statutory rate and then add that back to the ETR numerator. So this may well be seen as a favorable result for these countries.
The favorable treatment's called a safe harbor. And so if you were to read the document, you might think, oh, so if I get thrown out of the safe harbor, do I get thrown back into the full rules and fail to benefit from this beneficial treatment? The answer to that is no. This is a safe harbor that you elect into and you get the beneficial treatment irrespective of the outcome of that treatment, which I think just indicates that this might be described as a safe harbor, but it isn't a safe harbor as any of us would understand one. But hopefully it is a safe harbor for the purposes of the EU directive, which potentially was important.
You're so cynical, Alistair.
Okay. So as we mentioned earlier, the United States was not the only country who was hoping to get something out of the negotiations surrounding the OECD agreement. Conrad, can you talk about the motivations of some of the other countries involved in the negotiations?
Sure. So from the perspective of the major European advocates of the Pillar 2 system of rules, including the European Commission and some of the larger countries such as France and Germany, clearly their focus was on preserving the Pillar 2 framework intact. And they recognized back in June in the G7 agreement the need for the side-by-side approach to satisfy the US. At the same time, it's understood that they wanted to limit the extent of other modifications, such as the more generous treatment of tax incentives to some degree, at least, so that the rules would have a degree of teeth. And of course, we do now have this UPE safe harbor with conditions, but that does replace the condition light UTPR safe harbor that previously existed. So the focus on ensuring that the rules retain some robustness was clearly a focus of theirs. And what you can see from the media reports was that some of the smaller EU states were quite vocal in pushing for more generous protection for tax incentives, as it was the case in Asia-Pacific countries, as I mentioned before. And we also saw that some of the EU states took the opportunity to express their discontent with the Pillar 2 project as a whole, albeit ultimately they got in line with the compromise that was arrived at. And so on the whole, it would seem that the main European and Asian countries that advocate for the Pillar 2 system will be generally satisfied that a degree of stability has been brought to the framework, although, of course, they'll be monitoring closely for impacts on competitiveness and on business compliance burdens looking ahead. And that's been emphasized a lot by the business communities in Europe.
Thanks. So it seems like the OECD agreement addresses the concerns of some of the rest of the world countries through the UPE safe harbor. Conrad, can you explain this safe harbor and its implications?
Yeah, the UPE safe harbor, as mentioned before, it goes partly in the direction of what the SBS safe harbor achieves, albeit under the side-by-side approach, you're turning off both UTPRs and IIRs in relation to the home country profits of a multinational as well as overseas profits. The UPE safe harbor is much reduced. It just turns off foreign UTPRs in respect of the home country profits of a multinational. So it's a replacement for the old UTPR safe harbor, but with tougher conditions. And the tougher conditions are that you do need a domestic alternative minimum tax with a 15% or above rate. You do need to essentially promise that it will only be in limited circumstances that you would have groups that have an effective tax rate as calculated under the Pillar 2 rules that falls beneath 15%, although that's essentially a broad commitment, something that would be tested later on, probably through this stock take in 2029. And one of the conditions for that, the UP safe harbor, is that you have this 20% statutory rate applying to a comprehensive measure of income. So clearly the expectation would be that the country in question taxes not just domestic sourced profits, but also foreign sourced profits. So if you had, say, a country with a 20% rate, but a territorial regime that didn't tax foreign sourced profits, that presumably wouldn't fall within this meaning of comprehensive taxation.
Thanks, Conrad. So let's turn now to Alistair to talk about the final safe harbors in the package. Since Pillar 2 came online, many multinationals have avoided top-up tax under the transitional country-by-country safe harbor, which is set to expire in 2026. How does this side-by-side package address this?
Yeah, so we were expecting or hoping that there may be an extension of the transitional CBCR safe harbor that's been trailed quite widely. And that was something that the package confirms. And so I think that's something that all multinationals, US and non-US multinationals, will be thankful for. And so that just gives everyone that additional year to get ready for when they think about Pillar 2 compliance. But I think, as we're going to talk about, there is also a new permanent safe harbor that should simplify the rules in the long run. So it may be that groups can also look forward to that as a way to simplify their compliance when the transitional CBCR safe harbor ceases to apply.
So the final safe harbor is the permanent simplified effective tax rate, or ETR, safe harbor. How does this work? Is it actually a simplified calculation?
Yeah, Christian, this is a really good question. And I think it's probably the million-dollar question when we think about the simplification of the Pillar 2 rules. The side-by-side package is 88 pages long. Almost 60 of those pages are devoted to the simplified ETR safe harbor. So that is significantly more words than was devoted to the transitional CBCR safe harbor in the commentary that's been released previously. And I think that just indicates that while the simplified ETR safe harbor is definitely a simplification on the full rules, it is much more complex than what people have experienced with the transitional CBCR safe harbor. Some of those changes are going to be taxpayer favorable. So there's the incorporation of a series of adjustments, for example, for excluded dividends or excluded equity gains or losses, which was available in the full rules, but was not available in the transitional CBCR safe harbor rules, and so have been causing people problems where they were being unfairly and inappropriately kicked out of the transitional CBCR safe harbor. But there is a whole lot of additional complexity in various mandatory adjustments that are going to be required to both income and tax that weren't available in the transitional CBCR safe harbor. And so what people are going to need to think about is, when they prepare for Pillar 2 compliance, do they feel that they get a benefit from applying the simplified ETR safe harbor? Do they see that benefit recurring in jurisdictions where they continue to be eligible for the safe harbor year over year? And what happens in jurisdictions where they potentially transition in and out of the simplified ETR safe harbor? So you're able to do that, which you weren't under the transitional CBCR safe harbor, but then you have the complexity of having to do one calculation one year and one calculation another year, which potentially is quite onerous.
Alistair, is there any chance that the simplified safe harbor eventually subsumes the model rules? I mean, the whole point of this is, you know, there's been so many complaints about complexity. This is still complex, but at least simpler than the, I don't know, thousands of pages of model rules and commentary that's come before it. Any chance they at least take some of the learnings from this to alter and make simple the model rules themselves?
I think that's very likely. So one of the other things that this simplified ETR safe harbor does is it seeks to clarify a number of different aspects of the Pillar 2 model rules that are unclear, for example, in the treatment of transfer pricing adjustments or post-year-end tax adjustments. And the guidance states very clearly that there'll be consideration to taking those clarifications into the full rules. So there is going to be this fertilization of the model rules with learnings and ideas that have been articulated in the simplified ETR safe harbor.
Thanks, Alistair. So I want to shift our discussion to the future of Pillar 2. It's become pretty clear that the QDMTT is critical for Pillar 2's sustainability, but not all countries have adopted a QDMTT or even a DMTT. Conrad, how stable do we think the Pillar 2 system is going forward? And could we see countries exit the Pillar 2 regime in the future?
Well, I think clearly that the next few months will be key to monitor. If I go back to Asia Pacific, many jurisdictions in Asia Pacific would be highly sensitive to their perceived relative investment attractiveness, like Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand. And as such, the expectation would be that policymakers in these countries will weigh up how they fare with local QDMTTs in terms of their investment appeal under this newly revised Pillar 2 framework globally. And factors that will play into that assessment will be the understanding set out in the side-by-side package that full tax relief will be given at UPE level for foreign QDMTTs. That's now been confirmed. And of course, the increased latitude that countries have to offer tax incentives that will be protected from Pillar 2. So some countries may conclude that these factors allow them to preserve their investment attractiveness while retaining their QDMTT rules, and conceivably some countries could reach a different conclusion. So very much a matter to watch for in the coming year.
As you already mentioned, Conrad, as part of this package in 2029, there's an agreement to engage in a stock take to see how the side-by-side package has impacted global taxation, in particular to ensure that an unlevel playing field hasn't been created. Do you think this could further impact the stability of Pillar 2? And you know, what could happen if, for instance, from now until 2029, we see an uptick in inversions into the US? And by the way, that's a question I thought I would never have to ask, if there would be inversions into the US. What are your thoughts on that, Conrad?
Well, Michael may have additional comments on this, but what I would say is that the package report, when it talks about the stock take, sets out a number of objectives for it. So amongst the objectives is that they'll look at how countries that have elected into this UPE safe harbor regime, how their qualified UPE regimes might be aligned with the QDMTT alongside the work on identifying risks to the level playing field from both the UPE safe harbor and the side-by-side safe harbor regimes. And the report mentions the possibility of having targeted solutions for more concentrated level playing field risks. And that would be in line with what they've done in the past in their various batches of administrative guidance, where they made various rule tweaks and brought in certain anti-avoidance rules. So that wouldn't be out of character. The stock take itself doesn't mention any wholesale re-evaluation of the UPE safe harbor or the side-by-side safe harbor as something that they would bring into contemplation. And indeed, those safe harbors are supposed to be permanent. They're not time restricted. So at an assumption, they would be looking at a more targeted fixes. But of course, we have to see how the system evolves. But Michael, you might have further thoughts on this.
Yeah, Conrad, I think you're exactly right to what that stock take process is going to look like. But I've been hearing a fair amount of angst about the stock take. And so I think it's important to also point out that you don't even need a stock take for countries to abandon the side-by-side system, if that's what folks are afraid of, right? If countries don't think it's fair, it's not going to last. So I tend to come at it from the other direction. Yeah, I think the stock take is important because it was critical to getting an agreement now and to getting the hopeful stability that we'll see.
That's like having a provision in your prenup that in 5 years you're going to reassess your marriage.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the fact is you are reassessing your marriage potentially next year.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait until 5 years.
Thanks, Michael. So before we wrap up our discussion today, are there any questions still left unanswered by the OECD agreement?
Yeah. It's sort of like the Jelly of the Month Club. It's the gift that we'll keep on giving. There will be questions that need to be answered. I mean, just as some simple examples, there are a handful of model rules that look to the ETR in a jurisdiction and that will apply to transactions between the U.S. and a QDMTT jurisdiction. So the intercompany financing rule in 327, the transfer pricing adjustment rule. It's not clear how those rules coordinate with the side-by-side system. There's also a question of, for transfers of assets out of the U.S., the impact of that will depend on when the transition year for the U.S. is. And in this context, when is the transition year for U.S. M&Es? But there will be many, many more examples of technical questions that need to be addressed here.
Just to supplement, and I fully agree with that, Michael, on that, but to supplement, if you word search the package document for further work, you'll throw up numerous instances in which the OECDs have said, yes, this part of whether it's the simplified ETR safe harbor or the rules around incentives need to be further worked on in the first half of 2026 and beyond. Numerous different bits and pieces that they've highlighted. One of the ones that really stuck out for me is in relation to the treatment of incentives and the so-called related benefits rules. And these were flagged a long time ago. They were put on hold pending the finalization of the side-by-side package. But essentially what this looks at is whether a tax is returned to companies via various incentives. And if that's considered to be the case, and even if there are incentives that would normally be protected under the rules, you might see a reduction in covered taxes for that. So they have to finalize those rules. And I think for countries that are looking to update or refresh their tax incentives following the side-by-side package coming out and these clarifications on QTI and so on, they still will need to see the shape of these related benefits rules before they can finalize their new arrangements.
Right, Alistair, as we wrap up today, any final thoughts to share with our listeners on the agreement and Pillar 2 generally?
I think one of the big things it shows is that where you've got an international tax agreement that doesn't work for the US, you can't just bury your head in the sand and hope that eventually the US is going to accept the agreement that doesn't work for the US. And I think the other big thing that countries outside the US will have learned is that it's US Congress that sets US tax policy. And so if you don't have US Congress on board, you don't have the US on board. And I think that's very striking. If you said 3 years ago that this was ultimately the deal that was going to be agreed, I don't think anyone would have believed you. But it doesn't seem that surprising now we're sitting here in 2026.
I'd say that notwithstanding what I just said about the need for further work and technical issue to be resolved, I think it's really important just to recognize that this is a significant step forward in terms of stability for Pillar 2. It delivers a lot of simplification for U.S. multinationals and others. There obviously will continue to be questions that the inclusive framework will have to answer. But I think really what's interesting to me is going to be to see how countries respond to the new system, a lot of things that Conrad and Alistair have been talking about throughout this podcast.
Conrad, do you have any final thoughts?
Well, simply to echo what Michael has just said, that, you know, so much of the focus has been over the past few months on the negotiations at the inclusive framework level, the OECD's work on developing this package. But now the ball in 2026 very much moves to the countries, their policy decision on whether they want to retain the rules, whether they want to roll them back, what new countries will come along to adopt the rules, particularly if they are looking to simplify the QDMTT further, as they promised. And then the question around what countries do with their tax incentives, how they modify those to retain and enhance their attractiveness, and what degree of consultation they'll have with the business community on making that redesign.
Thank you, Michael, Conrad, and Alistair, for your insights into the side-by-side package and its potential implications. A special thank you to Casey Caldwell for her help behind the scenes with this episode. We'll continue to monitor the impact of the OECD agreement and the response from U.S. multinationals and other countries. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.